Chapter 15.
With my most loyal men, I cut my way into the throne room, detaining all within. There I executed the queen with my own hands in front of her most loyal subjects and family, her daughter, the young princess, included. She was a girl of 9 years, screaming traitor, treason, and that she would see me hung by my own entrails for murdering her mother. I was shocked that a child so young could speak of such violence, but then I realized that she wasn't a normal child. She was an aristocrat, bred to be cruel and selfish. That girl would live her entire life with the intent to see me dead, as with the families of all those I had already executed. I suddenly knew that if Hamara was to have any peace going forward, all possible threats had to be dealt with. So I executed the girl just a few minutes after her mother, her screams of hatred and vengeance upon me echoing through the hall right up until I separated her head from her small body. After that, I ordered the executions of every aristocratic family. Grandfather, grandmother, son, daughter, child, and babe. All killed at my command. After, once I was finally alone, I knelt, expecting to cry at the horror I had just committed. But no tears came. I could feel nothing.
Master Archons, we're about to arrive in Trermain. Lyra sat up from the bench where she had slept. Cusag was already awake.
Good. I'm hungry, he said. Bring me food.
Yes, of course, the junior postman said. Hamaran born by the look of him, and young, probably his first employment. Lyra and Cusag were in the main cargo hold of the National Post's ship, where two flat benches had been fixed to the sides, in case of the odd passenger. Sacks of letters and parcels lay around them. It had been a very restless few hours.
"This is all we have, masters," the postman said, once he had returned, and he handed Cusag an open can of beans with a fork.
Cusag took the can, his eyes staring at the postman, and his face blank. The postman handed Lyra the other can and fork, and then returned to the helm. Cusag threw the fork aside and hesitantly scooped a small handful of beans into his mouth.
"Ooh, this is bad. This is very, very bad," Cusag said, after struggling to swallow. "If this is what putting food in metal does, I will never do. Tastes like rust."
Lyra ate her beans. "There's nothing wrong with them."
"Yes, you Hamarans think if the food does not kill you, it is good. There is more to food than this. Like taste."
"These beans have plenty of taste. Nothing like some good rust." Cusag looked at Lyra in such astonishment that she burst out laughing.
"Why are you doing this? What is funny?" Cusag said, bewildered.
"Your face, Cusag. And here I thought you didn't like using facial expressions, but right then you looked like I had just turned into a goat." Cusag suddenly looked deeply embarrassed, or embarrassed enough, for he tried to make his face impassive.
I choose to show my face like this to show how unclean it is that you like to eat rust."
"Cusag, I was joking."
"Then you lied?"
"No, it's sarcasm."
"Sarcasm is not to joke. You must mean what you say."
"I do. Except when I don't." Cusag's blank expression cracked once more.
What? This does not make sense."
Lyra shrugged. "I'm a woman. We're allowed to not make any sense."
"What?"
"Exactly."
"That is enough. You hurt my head, strange woman."
Lyra chuckled to herself one last time as she felt the ship descend. It would still take a little while to reach the city, and Q to enter its airspace. Cusack got back to choking down his beans before throwing the can away in disgust once he was finished. He picked up a handful of letters and cleaned his hand with them. Cusack, you don't clean your hands with letters. Light. That's what the fork was for.
How do I clean my hand with a fork?
No, you use the fork to eat your food, and then you wouldn't have to clean your hands in the first place.
I am not a barbarian.
Cusack paused. Lyra guessed he had just remembered to not call her that.
I am not war maker. I do not use fork.
How does using a fork make me a war maker, whatever that means?
Simple. It can be used as weapon. You do not bring weapons to eat. Eating is for peace. Only war makers eat with weapons.
Your hands can be used as weapons too.
They are not meant to be weapons. You use hands to fight only when you have no weapons, and hands are not as good as weapons. Even fork better than bare hands, which is why for peace you must not fork.
You must not fork? Cusack, fork isn't a verb.
What is verb?
A word that means a type of action.
Then I make it verb, and I will never fork.
You sound ridiculous.
No, you are ridiculous, and you can fork as much as you like.
Whatever, Lyra said, waving a hand. Cusack huffed and stood with his back to Lyra. He began to go through the ritualized series of movements he did at the beginning of every fall, the same time as Lyra usually went for her run. She sighed in annoyance, as a long run would have done her good. She felt restless and frustrated, though teasing Cusack had helped. Cusack was clearly practicing some type of martial art, but it appeared far more formal than anything from Hamara. The ship eventually docked, and Lyra bid the pilots goodbye. It was the break of High Fall. Many people were just now arising, yet the city seemed to be in commotion, and it didn't take long to find out why.
Extra, extra! Daedalus the Conqueror has been living in hiding for last 20 years. Read all about it!
Lyra nearly fell over when hearing the call.
By the Bright One, Cusack said, looking to the paperboy in astonishment.
There was a crowd of people clamoring around, practically ripping the extras out of the boy's hands. With her free bond, Lyra channeled light into her voice and said,
Move!
Bonding light to one's voice would not only increase the volume of what one said, but it also had a supernatural effect to encourage obedience, agreement, and understanding, depending on what one said. Added that to the fact that Lyra was an archknight, the people parted at once. Lyra marched upon the paperboy and extended her hand. The boy handed her an extra with a trembling hand. She read. Apparently, some farmer from a village named Carradale had found a note in the home of the local tinker, written by the same, confessing that he was actually Daedalus the Conqueror, that he had escaped his supposed defeat 20 years ago and had been living in secret up until the last few falls, whereupon his imminent death he chose to cast himself from the edge of the world to die on his own terms. Adding to the validity of the claim was a book found at the scene, which contained an accounting of the Conqueror's life. A Lightbringer was also present during the discovery, who had both met the Tinker and seen the Conqueror when he ruled, confirming their resemblance in appearance and voice. On top of it all, it appeared that Daedalus had fathered a son in his old age, who was present when the Conqueror had cast himself from the continent. Also named Daelin, he was supposedly the express image of his father. There were even 2 drawings which had been printed next to the article, one a representation of what the artist thought Daedalus the Conqueror would look like in old age, scowling and malevolent, and another a young man who simply looked like Daedalus the Conqueror in his youth. The images nearly stopped Lyra's heart from the shock. The extra claimed that this was all discovered on the eve of last low, only taking a fall for the information to reach the city and get out. Lyra's fist slowly crunched the extra bit by bit. She clenched her teeth and took stock. She would control herself. She was an Archon. She was strong. But light, was it hard? Anyone old enough to have lived during the Conqueror's reign, like Lyra, could name one if not several things he had done to ruin their lives. There was no one in the world Lyra despised more than the great bastard. All had cause to hate him, and now, knowing that he had been living in peace for 20 years, was almost too much to bear. His note claimed that living with his guilt had tortured the bastard, but Lyra didn't believe that for a second. He had been a coward to the end. If he had been truly sorry for what he had done, he would have turned himself over to the world's judgment. Yet at the end of his life, he couldn't even do that. And he had fathered another child? This son, this Daylan, could be a great threat and needed to be questioned, but that was a matter for the authorities. At least the world, and indeed Lyra herself, finally had confirmation that the Conqueror, the filthy, perverted wretch, was now dead. Of course they thought they'd had confirmation for the last 20 years. So could they be sure of anything? All the more reason why the son needed to be questioned, if only to confirm the truth. Lyra stood for a little while with a face frozen in disgust, as she took long, controlled breaths to calm herself. Once she felt she was back in control, she tried to tell herself that it didn't concern her. She had a mission to focus on. Lyra threw the scrunched-up extra aside and left, Cusaig following behind. Cusaig wanted to talk about the article. He was quite amazed by the revelation. Daylas had conquered Tures as well as most of the world, so the news was as poignant to him as it was to anyone from Hamara. Lyra couldn't handle it, however, and answered abruptly to each of his comments. She focused on their mission, and after locating the dock where the boy had arrived, she bound light to her sense of smell and eventually found his scent. She couldn't help but constantly picture an old man as she tracked him. This frustrated her, because subconsciously she expected this boy to be moving at the same trudging rate one usually attributed to older people, which certainly wasn't the case. They tracked the boy to a road out of the city, heading south. Luckily, their quarry was on foot, which made the tracking much easier, and Cusaig commandeered the fastest coach they could find, a sleek, sporty sky coach. The coachman was accommodating, of course, and clearly nervous to serve 2 Archons. They flew through one of the smaller openings in the shield net, one which had sat near its base, made for coaches and the like, flying as fast as possible. Lyra ordered the coach to fly low and opened her side window to keep track of the scent. The sleek coach, almost like a racer in design, moved at an incredible speed, which caused the wind to whistle outside. Sky coaches like this were built for the elite of society, and the interiors were furnished to suit. Such lavishness made Lyra's skin crawl for several reasons, one in particular threatening to bring on a panic attack. Cusaig, on the other hand, was lounging amongst the cushioned seats and pillows, eating a small cake he had found along the way, looking completely at ease. Lyra had thrown the cushions away from her like they were infected, and now sat there gingerly, taking deep, even breaths.
"Ah, this is much better," Cusaig said. "A nice carriage, and this cake is not awful, but still not good. May the Bright One be praised."
Looking for anything to distract her from the decor, Lyra sought conversation, as precarious as that could be with her companion. "Who is this Bright One you keep referring to? I assume it's the light, but the way you speak of it, it's like you believe the light is a person."
"Not a person like us, but most certainly embodied."
Now that comment did distract her. Wait, you think the light has a body?
Yes. It's clear that the light has more substance than you Hamarans think.
That's ridiculous. How could the light see all things if it was restricted to two eyes like us? Cusack laughed.
It is what you Hamarans believe that is ridiculous. And we Turasians are not the only people who know the light has a body. The people of Frey believe that God has a body, though it is true we differ much after this belief.
God? What does that mean?
It is another name for the light.
God. What an ugly word. It sounds like a name for a pimple. Like, bother, I got another god on my face.
Cusack leaned forward angrily.
You speak blasphemy, Lyra.
Sorry. Light, I didn't mean to offend.
Then do not speak like this again.
Sure, fine. With that, the conversation was truly over. Looking out the window, Lyra tried to make note of everything they passed. They flew over the occasional person on the road, and even a ground-based coach, traveling in the opposite direction. Lyra could have seen the people clearly if she had bonded light to her eyes, but it was unlikely that their quarry would still be on the road. Besides, tracking the scent was more important, and it was even stronger now, meaning they were closing the distance.
Nothing much can be said for the food in your country, but at least your people know how to be comfortable,
Cusack said, his body spread over the cushions. Lyra threw a disapproving glare at Cusack, who took on a puzzled expression.
Oh, light, Lyra thought, remembering that Cusack couldn't read subtle facial expressions,
and probably thought the glare was some sign of sexual attraction, or at least that's what he would have thought before they'd had their little chat.
I can tell that you didn't understand what my look meant.
That is because speaking through face is a sign of no control.
Yes. So, Turasians don't like to show facial expressions?
No, this is not true. You have seen me speak with my face. Look.
Cusack put on a very pronounced look of displeasure.
We show faces that we want to show. Letting the face speak by itself is a sign of weakness. Feelings are to be controlled, so a strong mind only shows the things with his face that he want to show.
But you still can't understand subtle facial expressions.
Yes, this is hard for me. If you do not tell me, I think the look you give me is to have sex.
Why under the light do you think that? It's like everything you don't understand must be a sign of sexual attraction.
Because I show my body, and my body is strong and beautiful. Most women who look at me, and men who like men, is thinking of sex. Sex is the strongest of feelings and the hardest to master. Among my people, the feelings that most people show but do not wish to show are those feeling about sex.
Lyra nervously curled her fist tight as Cusack spoke so unashamedly.
So the feelings that people show among your people, Cusack continued, I think must be about sex, because it is those feelings that are more shown among my people who have not mastered them. This is much more for men. You see, it is the most, bad sign of weakness for a man's penis to become strong.
Cusack!
What? What do I say that makes you so?
Cusack asked, with all the innocent naivety of a child.
Stop. Just stop. You always act strange when I speak of this. Which is strange, for you are very old and must have sex many times. It is just sex.
No, Cusack, it's not. It's never just sex.
I am confused. You must master these feelings, Lyra, or these feelings will come to master you.
That comment stung more than Cusack could ever know. Lyra turned away to look out the window and said no more.
Thankfully, Cusack said nothing either, and they traveled in silence. Eventually, the scent that Lyra had been tracking suddenly peaked. "Stop," Lyra ordered the driver.
"What is it?" Cusack asked.
"The scent. It's very strong here." The sky coach circled and landed on a clear field of grass near some old brick shack. Once out of the coach, Lyra easily identified the source of the heightened scent. It was the hovel she had seen as they circled. It sat on the side of the road with 10 civic guardsmen surrounding it. Several suited men stood in front of the house, conversing.
"What is this?"
Cusack asked. The constables saluted both of them as they approached.
"Lady Archon," a constable said. I didn't realize the Order would have an interest in this, but now I think of it."
"An interest in what? Whose home is this?"
You don't know?"
"Would I be asking if I did, Constable?"
The constable was paling.
"Well, it turns out that this is the home that Daedalus the Conqueror had been living in, while in hiding."
"What?"
"Yes, most unsettling."
Lyra couldn't believe what she was hearing.
"Lord and Lady Archons," a portly man said respectfully, dressed in a tailed suit and top hat. A bejeweled cutlass hung at his side, and he was flanked by 3 similarly dressed men, as well as a commoner.
"I am the Magistrate of Caradale, Laramon of the Devashian family, and with me is Councilman Curatale Devashian, Master Tarim of the Hanathor family, and Master Peridan, one of the local farmers. We are honored by your presence."
Caradale, Lyra realized. That was the village mentioned in the extra.
"Magister," Lyra said, trying to regain her composure,
"you are certain of this? That this is the home Daedalus the Conqueror spent his final 20 years in?"
Yes, Lady Archon," the Magister answered haltingly, before continuing with haste. "Truly, none of us had any idea, and if we had, we would have taken appropriate action to bring the war criminal to the authorities."
"Your superiors will deal with that," Lyra replied with difficulty.
"I'm looking for someone. A young man, blue hair, and he spent a good amount of time here very recently."
"Yes, the son."
This is what Lyra had been dreading ever since realizing where they had come.
"He spent the low here with a lightbringer," the Magister said. "Master Paradin here met the two and was the one to find the note and journal."
"Describe the boy to me," Lyra demanded of the farmer.
"Of course, Lady Archon. Well, he was a surly lad with a chip on his shoulder, that's for sure. Actually, a lot like the old tinker."
The farmer scowled.
"Daedalus the Conqueror. He had blue hair, was fit, tall. Aside from age, he looked and sounded just like his father. Yeah, there's no question he was the tinker's son. And there's no doubt the tinker was Daedalus the Conqueror, what with the things we've dug up in this old house here. Makes my skin crawl knowing who lived here."
"What have you found?"
It was the Magister who replied. "There was a journal containing an account of the Conqueror's life, as well as several personal items that have been identified as belonging to the Conqueror. We also found money. Lots of money."
"Has anyone else spent time here recently of a similar description? Young, with blue hair?"
"Apart from his own son, no. Not to my knowledge, at least."
That settled it. The description combined with the scent trail meant that the young man they hunted was the son of Daedalus the Conqueror, and he was not an arch-knight. There was no way a boy who looked exactly like Daedalus the Conqueror could have joined the arch-knights without anyone, especially herself, noticing. This also explained why the boy's scent was faintly familiar, and why he smelled like an old man, having lived with his aged father. Lyra looked to Cusaig, who had a knowing expression. He'd put it together as well, except he probably thought the boy had underwent his own vigil after dedicating his life to fighting evil. Lyra didn't know if that was truly necessary anymore. There was no way the child of the greatest tyrant the world had ever seen would be selfless enough to dedicate his life to such a cause. The boy might have even murdered someone, that beggar in the alleyway. There might be no moral requirement to become a lightbinder, only the vigil. Now, if this was true, Lyra understood why the knights would lie to the world. Better evil men think they're morally disqualified from getting the powers than simply not knowing the secret. If anyone could become a lightbinder, what would people do to try and learn the secrets of the vigil? And then where would the world be? Lyra had to track down this boy and stop him as soon as possible. At the very least, he knew the secret of the vigil, and if that secret was revealed, the world would fall into chaos. "Where is he now?" Lyra demanded urgently.
"He caused a commotion in town before leaving. The captain tried to detain him, but the lightbringer he was with wouldn't allow it.
Where is he?"
"He caught a coach," the magister sputtered. "Headed for Tremaine."
"The coach!" Lyra spat, turning to Cusaig.
"Light! We pass the blackened thing on our way here!"